Accession number 28354, reel 13.
And we were talking about what the fleet was doing, was working out for Syria's operation, but then you mentioned Cyprus at the end of the previous tape.
Yeah, there was usually four, I can't remember how many ships, but there was a representation of the Mediterranean fleet always off Cyprus. But I've really forgotten which particular Cyprus crisis this was. Macarius, I think, by then was in the Seychelles, but I can't really remember. Why there was a crisis, but there usually was one in Cyprus. I remember it blew up on the...
There was Eoka at this time, wasn't there?
Yes. It blew up for some reason on Boxing Day of 1955, I should think this was. And four ships of the frigate squadron were sailed. This is John Bush's squadron, the John Bush you just interviewed.
Yes.
The same John Bush I was talking about earlier, who actually came to see me as chief of staff to flag officer flotillas, to tell me that his frigate squadron, so long as I understood that his frigate squadron was the best squadron in the Navy, and that HMS Undine was the best ship in that squadron, then he and I would get on very well together. Anyway, on Boxing Day of 1955, I think this must be 55, there was a panic, and his frigate squadron, the first frigate squadron, I think it was called, were told to sail for Cyprus. There was a Grigali blowing. The Grigali is the very, very fierce easterly gale that comes into Malta and really pounds the island and lasts usually about 2 or 3 days. And this was blowing at its full force. And these ships were told to sail. I remember driving down to Dragut Point, which was doesn't matter, the entrance to Sliema Harbour, to watch these ships going out. And one they all sailed all right. Undine sailed, and then Ursa went out, and the next ship, Ulysses, went out. The next, I can't remember the name of the final ship, but it obviously began with U, Urania. Doesn't matter. As she went out, some of the sailors were still on the forecastle, securing the forecastle after they'd slipped from the buoy, and they dipped into these huge waves in the entrance to Sliema Harbour, and four men, I think it was, were swept over the side, one of whom drowned. And I remember rushing back to my office, seeing this happening, because I was on the point, and saw them going out, and calling up tugs and things to go and try and save these men. One of them was drowned. And that very badly affected that captain of that ship. He always blamed himself, poor man, that he lost that man, lost the chap over the side. And did leave the Navy, not a great... He stayed in the ship, but left the Navy not long afterwards. Can you stop a minute, because I'm losing the thread? I'll divert to a story. The Admiral's driver. The Admiral's driver was a man who had a Maltese mother and an English father, Abel Seaman Moore. And Abel Seaman Moore had persuaded his Admiral that he spoke both, because of his Maltese ancestry, he spoke both French and Italian. He was sent to drive the car with the flag lieutenant from... He was taken over to Syracuse, and then he was told to take it up through Italy and drive it to Toulon, where the Admiral was going to pay a visit in HMS Manxman, his little flagship. And the flag lieutenant went up with him, and the two of them drove through Italy, and the flag lieutenant was persuaded, too, that this chap could speak Italian. He got by, but they needed to pump they got into France, but they needed to pump the tyres up of this Austin Princess, those great magnificent vehicles. And Abel Seaman Moore said to the man at the petrol station, "Trente," in his best French, and which is probably about the only word he knew. "And do you really mean it?" said the chap. "Trente," said. And so they pumped "Trente" in kilograms per square centimeter is absolutely colossal. But the towers held it, and they drove on. And then there were explosions, one after the other, as tower after tower burst. But it was a long time before Abel Seymour Moore was really rumbled, that he actually spoke neither of these languages at all. But they had an awful job replacing towers in the middle, on the Côte d'Azur at that time. We had a good trip in Toulon, actually. I can remember this trip. I went with the Admiral in Manxman. It was an extremely rough trip. And I remember in the bunk that I was in, which was brought one of these bunks that you fold up and it becomes a settee, that as the ship rolled so much, I was enfolded in the bunk because it closed with me in it and opened with me in it and closed with me in it extremely uncomfortably. I then got terrible toothache in Toulon and had a wisdom tooth taken out by an extremely nice young French dentist in the dockyard, who I can remember as he pressed and pulled and heaved, saying, "Ah, ça tient, ça tient." And by God, did it tient. It held like mad. However, he got it out. I don't remember much other of the visit to Toulon than that. But let's go back to the only thing of any major importance that happened in this time, which, of course, was the Suez Crisis. It was planned by the Flag Officer Second in Command, not us. He was to be the force commander. And he went, and Charles Mills, who was his chief of staff, flew to and fro from England planning this thing. We were only in on the periphery until near the time. And of course, the original plan, if I remember, I think, was just to go into Alexandria and start from there. But finally, it was a very muddled affair all the time. I was always very unhappy about this because it dragged on and on and on and on. And it always seemed to me that if you really believed that NASA taking over the Suez Canal had done some awful, terrible deed, you dealt with it immediately. And I'm sure we could have dealt with it immediately. I've never understood why we had to wait so long. But we're inclined to look on the worst side, and to give the enemy a potential which, of course, he never had. And I think this is the case in the case of the Suez Canal.
So this was months in the planning, was it?
It took months and months and months. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look up the actual dates that he walked into it and the date we went there, but months passed.
And of course, the longer this goes on, the more chance.
Yeah, I mean, by the time we took the operation, NASA had proved that there was no need for the British and the French in the canal. He was running it extremely well. There was no problem about it with it at all.
Yes.
I hated the whole operation. I was totally opposed to it personally. I thought it was misconstructed. This is not quite true. At the beginning, I thought we ought to go in, and I thought we had an excuse to go in quickly. But when we didn't do that, I thought we'd lost the argument and really shouldn't do anything. The Commander-in-Chief was Admiral Grantham, and I met years later when I met him quietly when he was retired. He told me that he had officially no idea where his fleet was sailing for when it left Malta. He did not actually know, he said. He knew, but he didn't know officially what was on. Such the secrecy kept from him and the planning kept away from him. It wasn't good at all, any of it. Our role was, as Flag Officer Flotillas, was the bombarding force. And my Admiral and myself and the staff went into HMS Nigeria. And we went across to port side, or off port side, with the landing craft, with the assault ships and the assault force. Curiously, my job I find quite difficult as Chief of Staff to the Admiral to start with limited numbers of ships, and it seemed quite a lot of tasks. I don't know, can't remember now what those were, but mostly training tasks, apart from Cyprus. It was always difficult to fulfil all the tasks. But suddenly, as the build-up for Suez took place and every ship available came out, the job became terribly easy. You had lots and lots and lots of ships and no trouble fulfilling any of the tasks you were given. So eventually the command was an extremely big one. I can't remember how many ships there were, but all the destroyers and frigates and minesweepers that came out to the Mediterranean for the operation, and land, not the landing ships, so those weren't ours, were under our command. And anyway, we went across to port side with the landing ships, and were off, obviously off it for the bombardment. I managed to... I don't think I need to go into it. The assault was extremely efficiently performed. I mean, it was, that part of the operation was very well planned. It's the 4 days beforehand when the RAF were bombing. This long, long period of, that I never understood. And of course it took 4 days with those very slow landing craft to get to port side. So there wasn't much surprise, I don't suppose.
Was there any Egyptian opposition?
Very minor. There was some, but very little. And the destroyers, we had destroyers close inshore bombarding. And one of them wouldn't stop bombarding, and this rather sickened me. He just went up and down, banging away, and would not. He did a blind Nelson touch stuff. When my admiral told him to cease fire, he just went on banging away. That was Captain Peter Hill Norton, who blasted away at beach defences, which were mostly only little villas and things, for a very long time.
Was there any...
HMS Norfolk was supposed to bombard, and the only thing I did achieve was to persuade the Admiral that she shouldn't fire a single round. It seemed to be absolutely unnecessary, and we didn't fire a single round.
Was there any comeback on Peter Hill Norton at all?
No.
There wasn't?
No. We then sat off the beachhead as things unfolded and the war came to an end when the Americans intervened with the pound, and poor Huey Stockwell, the general, whom I didn't know then but came to know so well later in life, had to withdraw. I still think it was I thought at the time it was wrong. I still think it's wrong. I was also very morally, so to speak, twisted at that time because, of course, the Hungarian invasion, the Russian invasion of Hungary was taking place, so the repression of the uprising there. And that, while we were bashing away at Egyptians when I thought we shouldn't be, I was sickened at the thought that we were doing nothing about the Hungarians.
There is a suggestion, of course, that the Russians rather regarded Suez as cover.
I think it's fortuitous cover. I don't think that they said, oh, they've done this, we'll go in. Do you? Oh,
I rather got that impression.
I wouldn't have thought so. I think they'd got that. It was cover, though. It was very good cover for them. Because NATO was so, and America was so involved with trying to stop us.
Yes.
Very unfortunate. What happened next? Back in Malta, and life did not go on quite the same, because the Mediterranean fleet then reorganized itself. And the flag officer flotillas was abolished. and the flag officer second in command, who had been responsible, the force commander for the Suez operation, took over all the destroyers and frigates, and I therefore was out of a job and was shuffled over sideways to take up the same position as Chief Staff Officer to the Flag Officer Malta, who's Admiral Madden. This wasn't really a job for a captain. The man I was relieving was an acting captain, a commander in the rank of acting captain, who managed to inflate the job, I reckon, for his own purposes very successfully, and I congratulated him on it. And I went into it, and it wasn't a job. It was no question, it was not a job for a captain. I was with Admiral Sir Charles Madden, or Rear Admiral Sir Charles Madden. He was Sir Charles because he's a baronet. A very, very nice man, and I liked him. I just didn't like the job. He had commanded the New Zealand Navy. He'd been the Chief of Naval Staff in the New Zealand Navy previously, and dealt with politicians, and reckoned he was pretty good at dealing with politicians. And he enjoyed dealing with Don Mintoff, the Prime Minister of Malta. And I personally thought that Don Mintoff ran rings around him. He's quite a different intriguer to any New Zealand politician which Charles Madden had had to deal with in Wellington. Mintoff was a great operator. But I really had nothing to do. I can't really tell you anything that I did in that job because I was superfluous. The staff officer operations ran the small amount of operations. The staff officer administration ran the administration of the shore side and the dockyard, insofar as Flag Officer Malta looked after that. And really, I had a supervisory position with no real responsibility or purpose, I thought. So we saw our time out in Malta in that job. And I went back then to England. What date are we now? We must have come up to about 1960 now.
Well, Suez was the end of 56, so you would have been, I don't know how long you were in this place with Admiral Madden. How long were you in the place with Admiral Madden?
I can't remember now when I came back. I'd have to look that up.
Okay.
Can you stop again? Because I'll
yes.
have to. I had hoped that I would do the Imperial, whatever it was, RCDC, Imperial Defence College.
Yes. RCDS.
After this job, and was so to speak, penciled in for it, I thought. And to my intense disappointment, I was sent as Deputy Director of Joint Plans in the Ministry of Defence. The Director of Plans was John Bush, and he had a deputy in the Admiralty, and his deputy in Joint Plans and the Ministry of Defence was me. There were three deputy directors of plans, one from each service. Colonel Basil Ditmus, a group captain, RAF, whose name is gone at the moment, and myself. And underneath us were various planning teams, a commander, a wing commander, and a lieutenant colonel in each one, to plan for different areas, for the Far East, for the Middle East, for NATO, etc. And our job was to produce for the directors of plans proposals for plans which we were detailed off to do by them through the Chiefs of Staff's Committee. So the Chiefs of Staff's Committee would decide who we were going to invade somewhere or other, or we needed a plan for something or other, and we wrote it. It was the most cumbersome affair, I think, but I suppose it had to be, and inevitably you got the what seemed to me the lowest common denominator, because you had to satisfy all three services. And it started with a provisional plan and a the second, first provisional, a second provisional, and a draft, and a first draft, and a second draft, and a final draft, and then a final. It was a very long-winded process indeed, through all these committees and to the chiefs, to the planning committee and the chiefs of staff. I think John Bush was an extremely good director of plans. He had a sharp mind and looked after the Navy side very well. But it was then an awful, awful battle between the services. We were all fighting our corners in a very disagreeable fashion. I hated Whitehall, and I did not like that job. So I didn't like the infighting and the intrigue. It really wasn't a sort of honest job. We did produce the plan. We did produce one plan that was actually implemented, and that plan was the Kuwait one. And if you remember, in 1960-ish or sometime at that, we did implement the Kuwait plan. Most of our plans just rotted on the shelf, and I think that's probably what ought to have happened to them anyway. Halfway through, John Bush was then moved on to, promoted, I think, to Rear Admiral. And so a new director of plans had to be found. And Charles Lamb, the then First Sea Lord, selected as director of plans Edward Ashmore, Captain Edward, who was considerably junior to me. And this is very interesting. The only time I've served under somebody very much my junior, so to speak. But it was actually entirely the right decision. Edward Ashmore was the right person to be director of plans, with his extremely sharp intellect and very cold. I can't think of the word to use for Edward Ashmore, but he was quite unemotional, I think, is the answer. If he had any emotions, they did not show. Whereas I was emotional and always got involved, and you shouldn't. Edward didn't. He could look at it from outside. So absolutely right that I was not made director of plans. Edward Ashmore was, and I was his deputy. And I had no feelings or worry about serving under him in that job at all. Again, I think he was a very good director of plans. Very cold fish, Edward Ashmore. Not everybody liked him. In fact, a lot of people disliked him. But he was an able operator, and in the right scene in Whitehall, he was extremely good. But this worked out for me very well indeed, because it meant. A lot of things worked out very well for him indeed. The captain of Hermes, David Tibbetts, wanted to go as deputy master of Trinity House, a job for which he was absolutely ideally suited. He was an extremely able navigator and technically a very able one too. And therefore he had to leave Hermes early, and by great good luck, Frank Twiss, who was then the naval secretary, asked me if I'd like to be captain of Hermes. And this did two things. It put me into a job I really wanted to do, and it took me out of plans. It was lovely. Now, 2 years before, David Tibbetts and I had sat down together having a drink somewhere or other. I'd known him very well. And he said, "Look, Bill, if I say in the fleet that you're going to leave me in Hermes, and you say it in the ministry of sense, perhaps you can get the job." And I actually never opened my mouth on the matter. I never said it. But whatever David Tibbetts did, I got it. And that was wonderful. One of those things that should have worked out and did. So I left the Ministry of Defence and went to Portsmouth, to Hermes, which was in refit. Quite a few months of refit still to do.
Was this the same Hermes that went to Falklands before?
Yes.
It was?
Yes.
So this was a fairly new ship?
Well, no. Hermes was built was launched in 1945, but she then stayed on the an unfinished carrier until 1950 something, and then she was taken in hand again, somewhat modified, an angled deck put on, and considerably a lot of additions, 984 radar, all sorts of things, and finally commissioned, David Tibbetts being the first commission, in I suppose about 1958, something of that order. And so David Tibbetts took her out on her first commission. Now, this is now 1961, I suppose. I took over late 60, November 1960, something like that. And yes, that's right. This is right. And we went to sea in 61. I've had to pull a book out to look at the dates. She was refitting, and not being very well refitted, actually. I don't think Portsmouth Dockyard was awfully good at that time. I had an extremely good engineer officer. And when the day was... Better just go back a bit. My first real shock in that ship came on Christmas Day. My wife and I were in a married quarter on the top of Portsdown Hill above Portsmouth, and the telephone rang at about 9 o'clock on Christmas Day, and a voice said, "This is Lieutenant Commander Bailey, sir." And I said, "Yes, Alec, I know the chef and news script, Alec, Happy Christmas." And there was a ghastly, ghastly silence, and he said, "There is a man hanging from the mast." And I said, "Christ!" And jumped into my. He sent the Land Rover up to collect me, and it arrived. And I jumped in Land Rover and went down, and sure enough, there was this body hanging. It had been the most tremendously cold night, a really arctic night, and he was absolutely solid, this poor boy. Anyway, we took him down, and Alec had gone up as officer of the day at 9 o'clock on this Christmas morning to hoist the ensign, which was all of the masts was including the ensign staff was in scaffolding, actually, and you could hardly see it. And he looked up casually to see what was going on, and saw this body hanging there.
Which is how the person got up there in the first place, using the scaffolding.
Using the scaffolding, yeah. He was a signalman. He was a youngster, an ordinary signalman, whose girlfriend had jilted him the previous afternoon. And he hanged himself, poor chap. So that was a bad Christmas morning. The commander, who was Stan McArdle, then got in his car and drove halfway around England, finding this chap's parents and family and telling them. And he didn't have a very good Christmas day either. We did actually have a party in the wardroom, because they'd arranged one at Christmas with a Christmas tree and for the few chaps still left on board. And I must say, it's one of the flattest sort of Christmas celebrations I can ever remember on board one of Her Majesty's ships. To go back to the refit, the ship. Nothing was ever ready in that ship, in that refit, on the date the dockyard said it would be. So you arrange for sailors to come back on board and to take up residence in their mess deck because their bathrooms, etc., were going to be finished, and they weren't. And we had this sort of difficulty and trauma with the dockyard all the way through. It was quite a fight. Eventually, the refit finished, and I think I'm going ahead of myself really on this, but I'll finish it off. And the Admiral Superintendent, who was a rear admiral, with his chief constructor and his chief engineer and others, did the rounds of the ship and the rounds of. And the engineer officer and I had tremendous fun here. This was enjoyable, because we made sure that we visited places which had not been finished or done well or properly, and then we would just say nothing, and he'd have to ask his superintending engineer and intellectual chap what was happening, and we succeeded in embarrassing these two very considerably, and they both deserve to be embarrassed, because one of them was actually, we knew, was drunk till about 11 o'clock in the morning, or hadn't come round from his previous drinking, and was quite useless. That was the constructor, actually. The engineer was quite sober, but he never came on board the ship. Nevertheless, it wasn't a bad refit, and everything did work. But of course, before we went to sea and made it work, we had to commission the ship, and we had a proper commissioning service, at which the colonel commandant of the Royal Corps of Signals came down and presented us with what they called a jimmy being the